Welcome back to Cage Club. Two movie fans, 72 movies, one cage. This is episode 6, The Cotton Club. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Manzi, and with me is...
Joey Lewandowski, I'm your other host. And this movie is the longest Cage movie of Cage Club yet. It's like 2 hours and 8 minutes. Nick Cage is not in it all that much. I mean, he's in it a decent amount, but he's again relegated to a background role.
Yeah, he's relegated to supporting actor, character, but, again, his... You know, an important character. Nonetheless, his presence is felt throughout the movie.
And even though he's not necessarily the star, this movie is loaded with all-star talent, both in front of the camera and behind the camera. It's directed by Francis Ford Coppola for the second or third time in Cage's career. Story by Mario Puzo, who wrote the Godfather stories. You have on screen, you have Richard Gere, you have Nicolas Cage, you have Lawrence Fishburne, you have Diane Lane again. You have, Lawrence Fishburne again, Tom Waits again.
Bob Hoskins, James Remar.
James Remar in a crazy bonkers role.
Yeah, I wrote down he's bonkers in this movie.
he's really turned all the way up. Yeah. He's on top of his crazy mob boss game right now.
Produced by Robert Evans. Does that name ring any bells to you?
It sounds familiar, but I don't know what he did.
He was a big time producer in the like 60s, 70s, and 80s. Love Story, Rosemary's Baby, a bunch of big movies, bunch of important movies back in the day. So that's just another in a long list of talent we got going
sure.
on today.
Nicolas Cage plays the character of Vincent Dwyer, Vinnie Dwyer. He's Irish. Although his accent doesn't really give away that he's Irish, his name doesn't really give away that he's Irish, I don't think. He just sort of seems Italian.
Yeah, he just seemed like a guy who grew up in New York to me at the turn of the century. Like sort of the prototypical New York mobster accent I was getting from him. Like this would be where that sort of accent started, right? And then it would go on to become like a stereotype even to... today and even in The Sopranos.
So what's sort of interesting about this movie and also kind of frustrating at times, I think it pays off by the end, but in the beginning and the middle it's sort of disjointed. It's kind of telling three different stories. All are intertwined, but they're all separated from the start.
It's all tied together with the Cotton Club itself. So it's like the story of the Dwyer brothers, and then you also have the Williams brothers, who are they're the tap act. So you get to sort of see what's going on the white side and the black side of town at this time up in Harlem, and the two different lives that the entertainers sort of lead. Their paths cross, all the characters sort of cross in and through the Cotton Club.
And I think it's important what you just said about you see the black side and the white side. Racism is a huge part of this movie, and in the beginning, sort of not at the forefront. It seems like it's just sort of happening around. The black Tap brothers can't go in the front door, they're told to go in the back door, all the help are black. There's sort of like an undercurrent, and by the end, it reaches a boiling point, and that's really a driving conflict, one of the few main driving conflicts in this movie.
Yeah, I felt that was interesting too, how it sort of started to seep through the edges of the film, and then by the end, it's, you know, basically painted the movie with it, with the message. And I think it did it pretty well, too. This is tough subject matter, you know, this is a tough time in American history, and today, it's hard to watch, like, Nick Cage, you know, utter the racial slurs and things
that.
It's like, woof, like, it hits hard.
There's one scene about halfway through the movie where him and Richard Gere are in a car, and between the two of them, they say the N-word, like, I don't know, 12 times in 30 seconds?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that must be intentional. That must have been written that way to sort of emphasize just how casual it all was, but it's just sort of cringeworthy. Like, it's so in your face and so aggressive.
That's sort of near a midpoint, too, and I think that goes with what I was trying to say is, like, as the movie goes on, the racism feels more rampant, even though there's less segregation by the end of the film, but the tension is higher.
And maybe that's why the tension's higher, because there's less segregation, it's more in your face.
Yes, yeah, they can't ignore it anymore.
So the movie takes place in Harlem in 1928, so we're in the heart of Prohibition. During this movie, we see the stock market crash. We sort of enter the Great Depression. The Dwyer brothers, Richard Gere and Nicolas Cage, are sort of like everyman bootleggers. They're just doing, I don't want to keep using the same word, but it kind of fits here. Nicolas Cage is kind of a hustler, again, just doing whatever he can get to do to get by. It seems like a lot of his successes come from bootlegging and from the alcohol trade that blossomed during Prohibition.
Yeah, I got the sense that he was one of the, like, kind of a petty thief almost at this point mm-hmm. when we first are introduced to him. And his brother is sort of a musical virtuoso. He can play piano, he can play the cornet, and he sort of gets Nick Cage in. He gets Nick Cage like in the door of mob life in a roundabout way. Almost becomes responsible for his downward path.
What's really impressive to me is that you're talking about how he's this musical virtuoso. Richard Gere is credited as, and you can see him in the movie playing the cornet, which looks like a sort of a trumpet-ish thing, and playing the piano, and he's, like, amazing. Like, the actor is just amazing at both.
Yeah, I don't know what he did before this. I wondered if Coppola sort of found him somewhere in a jazz club or, you know, some acting school where he was looking for an actor who could play instruments and came across Richard Gere. I don't know if that's what happened, but it was striking to me. I had no idea that he could play instruments.
I'm sort of the mind that most people in Hollywood can, to some extent, sing and dance and maybe play instruments. Because I feel like a lot of these people, unless they sort of lucked into it, almost like what happens to Dixie Dwyer in this movie, how he just sort of discovered as an actor. I feel like for a lot of people in Hollywood that they've devoted their life to becoming an actor, you know, they go to school for it and everything.
Yeah.
I feel like they've taken a lot of their free time to learn other stuff that could be useful in the skill of being an actor. So it never really, you know, shocks me when someone just busts out and they're like a great singer or they can play an instrument or they're like a great dancer. But it is sort of, it does still surprise me, and it is just sort of awesome to see.
You know what I guess felt strange to me is that he's sort of credited. You know, they go out of their way to credit him as, like, in the same way they say, you know, Tom Cruise was really hanging off the side of that airplane in Mission Impossible. It's like, you know, you better believe Richard Gere plays his own instruments.
Yeah, they say, like, in the opening credits, like, pretty high in the opening credits, it says Cornet Solos by Richard Gere. And I was like, oh, all right. And then, you know, over the opening credits, he's just playing away on the cornet.
Yeah, that opening scene was pretty cool, too, where he's not in the Cotton Club, and he's sort of starting out, and he's playing the cornet, and James Remar's, like, loving him. Like, it's the
yes.
most amazing thing he's ever heard. He's like, I own 6 radios, and this guy's the best thing I ever heard. Like, that, I felt, was when the film sort of veers off into more of a unintentionally comedic moment.
It's sort of weird to describe this movie in terms of genres, because it is kind of at times, not really, but it's sometimes comedic. But it is also on IMDb as one of the most interesting genre combinations I've ever seen. It's credited as a crime, drama, music.
I would agree with most of that. I was thinking a mob drama comedy, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of genres that could fit it.
Yeah, it almost feels like again, this is almost part of Coppola's style, but it feels like a play or something, right? Where it's got a little bit of everything in, because most people, like, you know, like a big Hollywood production of Broadway production of some kind put on film, you know, to the people who can't afford to go to Broadway to see, you know, like a big show. It feels like that type of movie, you know? Let's make a movie like a Broadway show.
I like that a lot. To me, when watching it, it sort of felt like a Scorsese movie. I don't know, maybe it's just because it's crime, maybe, but I feel like the music sort of made me think, I don't know why. I'm not sure if that's it grounded in anything, or just because it's, you know, a crime movie in New York, but it just reminded me of Scorsese.
We will get to Scorsese and Cage.
Nicolas Cage is introduced. His hair is relatively normal in this, but he does have a great, great great pencil mustache.
Yeah, it's very much in style at the time in this movie. Many people are sporting it. Richard Gere's got one. Lawrence Fishburne's got one. It seems to be most of the young guys are wearing that stash.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, it works. He works it. It works for him. Like, I think we mentioned last time, he's sort of this chameleon where he can just blend into the era. And they put him in that tweed jacket at first with that hat. You know, he looks almost like a paperboy.
Yeah.
Or like a newsie, I was thinking.
And I think that's done maybe to, because he does undergo like a huge transition in this from essentially, you know, small-time crook to basically the most wanted man in New York City, and so sort of seeing his costume change from this innocent newsy-like character to him in the wife beater, him in the more mob-associated clothes, is also like a visual transformation that matches his career transformation.
Yeah, yeah.
But whatever he's doing in the beginning of the movie, whether it's his mustache or his demeanor or his clothes, it's working for him because he's married to Baby herself, Jennifer Grey.
Yeah, relegated to the corner for most of this movie as well. He takes her on one run toward the end of the movie, right? He takes her on his fatal stick-up at the end. But aside from that, like, you hardly see her.
She's not in it that much. And thinking back to when she's on screen, it seems like she's just there to sort of cast condescending glances at whatever's going on.
Yeah, she's Vinny's wife, and she's pretty much... Seems to me like I thought she was playing like an underage wife almost, you know, like a child bride of some kind, just because of the way she was acting, you know. She's just very immature when she was even in it. And you hardly even see her face in the scenes that she's in. You just know that she's a presence. And I was like, not even sure it was Jennifer Grey. And then I saw in the credits that it was.
Again, this is 1984, so Cage is 20. Everybody is young. I mean, they all sort of, the way that they act... They seem older, or like what they're doing, they seem older. But later in the movie, and the whole movie pretty much revolves around sort of a forbidden love story between Richard Gere's Dixie Dwyer and Diane Lane's Vera Cicero. Toward the end of the movie, after Vera has her own club open, Richard Gere's talking to her. He's like, "Hey, you're just 21. You know, look at all the things you've done in the last 2 years." Like, she's so young, and she owns her own club. Like, it's like a different era. It's everything is different.
But she got that club because she's the mob boss's best girl. Like, she belongs to Dutch Schultz, so, like, he bought her the club. So that's, you know, it's not like she earned the club in any kind of legitimate way, but, you know, it's funny that, you know, Richard Gere doesn't even seem to realize that, you know. He's just like, "I don't care, man." He's like, "You can do whatever you want. Look at you. You've got your own club."
She has a really good line toward the end of the movie where she basically says something like, "You know, I was born looking 18. I think she's just sort of tired of it.
Yeah, and even Dutch Schultz calls her doll. I mean, doll was a popular thing to call a girl back then, but he does it, like, exclusively, you know, and calls her, "What a beautiful doll. Look at this doll. Like, this is my doll." Like, so she's very much just an object, and that's kind of what Dutch does. Like, he collects people and, like, keeps them so they can't do what they really want to do, right? Like, he even does it to Dixie, where he's like, "I'm going to hire you just so you can't work for anyone else, you know, just to keep you around." And he has to go to California to get far away from him to break those chains.
It's the ultimate power move.
Yeah, and it's even worse because he's like, "You know, I'm going to keep you within arm's distance of the girl you want, and I'm going to have her the whole time." So, tough situation.
Even though about halfway through the movie, James Remar says to Richard Gere, "Hey, I want you to take my girl out and show her a good time." And I was thinking, like, has that ever worked in a movie? Like, has that ever not led to trouble?
Yeah.
Whether they fall in love or... The only thing that I could think about when they didn't fall in love was in Pulp Fiction, when Travolta takes out Uma, but then she overdoses on heroin. It's just, like, that never works out well in movies.
Maybe it's just one of those mob tropes that was included. I did find that a little perplexing because of how possessive the Schultz character was. Maybe it was a test because he sends his ghoulish sort of enforcer to watch them all the time, you know? So he could have just been testing both of them, make sure they were loyal.
But it seems like, for the most part, Richard Gere sort of passes all of James Remar's tests, and he continues to rise and rise and ascend in his ranks until he's ultimately discovered and becomes this huge movie star out in California.
Yeah, and what was kind of crazy was for the Cage character, Vinny, because Richard Gere saves James Remar's life, like, James Remar, that's why he's like, you know, I'm keeping you around, this and that, and then Vinny's like, oh, that guy's a huge mob boss, like, get me a job with him. And Richard Gere's like, no, but Vinny goes, like, behind his back to get the job and, like, becomes, like, real tight with Dutch. And so now Richard Gere is, like, locked in, even though he personally can escape. His brother's trapped now.
And Cage, like, fully commits to this new mob lifestyle. Like, at one point he just shows up, I guess, I'm not sure exactly, I don't remember exactly what it was. Maybe it was just to intimidate people, because he doesn't kill anybody. But he just, like, walks into a club with a Tommy gun and just starts, like, shooting up the place.
I was trying to piece together what his racket was. So my theory is, you know, putting this together, he was sort of hired to be like a bookie, you know, like take bets and place and things like that, and like break people's legs when they don't pay. And from my understanding, there was already a racket like that in Harlem, and Nicolas Cage was sort of like pushing them out and taking over their turf. So he was like going from club to club, like, just lighting up the place, you know, letting people know not to mess with him.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and it's sort of like a little montage, right, where there's, like, money being thrown on a table and, like, Nicolas Cage's eyes, like, superimposed over cars being chased around corners, like, all very much a montage much in the style of a movie from 1928.
Yeah, it's visually reminiscent of older movies. Even, like, I think when the movie starts, like, the opening credits are meant to emulate like an old-timey 1920s movie.
Yeah, yeah. I remember thinking that they looked like the title cards for The Artist or, like, The Man Who Wasn't There, which were also sort of emulating movies of that, near that time.
For some reason, the DVD did not include English subtitles, and a lot of what's going on is sort of hard to hear, but I think that also plays into the type of movie that Francis Ford Coppola is making, in that there's just, like, a lot of action going on, and nobody, no matter how powerful they think they are, no matter how firm of a grasp they think they have on their situation, really knows everything that's going on. Maybe that's me trying to justify the fact that that it was difficult to follow certain scenes. I think that would be sort of interesting. The music's always loud. There's a lot of people doing a lot of different things, and nobody really knows the cards that the other people are playing.
Yeah, I would not put it past Coppola to have thought of that at some point during the production, to somehow work that in, because it's thematic, you know, there's betrayals and takeovers and, you know, secrets being kept and misinformation and things like that sort of drive the story along. And also just the idea of someone hearing someone but not really absorbing what they said. So you sort of hear someone in your peripheral and you didn't really understand what they were saying, even if they were talking to you. I sort of feel like, you know, he may be going for some of that.
Yeah, and it's like the second time in six movies that I can think of, with Valley Girl being the other example, where you're in clubs a lot of the time, and it does do a really good job of representing the feeling of being in there.
Yeah, the club sequences in this movie I felt were really well choreographed. Did a really good job of cutting back and forth between the stage show and driving the story along, you know, about what was happening at the tables around the stage that were watching the performance. Very hard, I would imagine, to keep track of all of this going on. Some sequences last for like 15 minutes, you know. Some nights at the club go on forever and many things happen. People show up out of left field. I felt really well balanced.
Those scenes that you're saying where they intercut between the dancing and the singing and the performing with the things that are going on around it, sort of reminded me of the baptism scene in The Godfather, where you have the one thing that's going on that's completely innocuous and, you know, family-friendly, and then behind the scenes you sort of get a sense of the seedy underbelly and, like, what's really happening.
Yeah, there was a really great sequence at the end when Dutch Schultz is being murdered, and it's cut between Gregory Hines doing one of the most amazing tap dance sequences I've ever seen in my entire life.
Going crazy.
It is insane, and it becomes, like, really tense and really sort of heart-pumping. Or it did for me. I got really into that moment.
His tap sounds literally become the soundtrack for the sequence. As he gets faster and faster, the scene gets more and more intense, and it works perfectly.
I also liked how, at moments, like, the tap dancing sort of was reminding me of like gunshots and like Tommy gun fire, because if you listen to like the rat-a-tat-tat of like the old school guns and stuff, and then like the tapping and everything, it's like, man, it must have been I would have been on edge 100% of the time if I was a mobster hanging out at that club, because I just think people are shooting at me left and right.
Even when you're in a place where you think you're safe, like that party about half an hour into the movie, where the guy just gets stabbed.
Yeah, that's, they're supposed to be sort of having a truce, sir.
Yeah, they're checking their guns at the door, and then one guy stabs another, and like at least one, if not a couple guys, just pull out guns that weren't checked. Like it seems like everybody always has guns, even in situations where they're not supposed to have any guns.
Cage, when he's hiding out at the end, you know, he sort of pulls off a kidnapping, and Gear goes to, his brother Dixie goes to bring him the money, and Cage just has like an arsenal laid out on his beds in the hotel room. I was like, whoa, these guys are, it's like Neo in the Matrix. He's just like getting ready to, he's like a one-man army, you know? I think it was at this point, he was trying to live up to his image in the paper, because he was like, Vinny, that is like, now I'm public enemy number one, time to juice up and live up to it and go out in a blaze of glory, perhaps, huh? I don't know.
Yeah, so before he kidnaps Frenchie, all I can think of whenever I see him is I just think of the judge in My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah, I think of Herman Munster.
Like, he does a good job of this movie, but he just reminds me of other things. But before he kidnaps him, is he tasked to kill that guy on the street, or is that just the initiative that he takes?
The guy on the street, Saul, who's like the enforcer for Dutch, after Cage sort of goes to him, they go to Vera's club, which is Diane Lane's club, right? And Vinny's like, I gotta talk to the Dutchman. And Dutch is like, you know, what do you want? And he's like, I delivered you Harlem, you know, you owe me, like, I need a bigger percentage of the racket and all this. And Dutch is like, well, you want to be a boss, you know, look at you, you can't be a boss. And Cage, and he's like, all right, I'll hire you $100 a week. And Cage like takes, he's like, take your $100 and shove it up your ass.
All right, so what do you say, wise guy?
I want to talk money in Dutch. We get shot up, no one seems to give a shit.
That's part of the game. All right, how much you need?
I'm talking real money, Dutch. Me and Eddie, we delivered half of Harlem to you, for Christ's sake. Now I want part of the numbers percentage, and I want a
number. Yeah, you out of your head, you crazy Nick. What's the matter with you? Just because you can handle a gun, you think you're a boss? You're nuts, you know that? You're fucking nuts. There's a million guys out there willing to pull the trigger for me for free. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a raise.
A raise?
$100 a week. And 50 for Pocky there. Is that fair?
Fair? You can take your 100 and you can shove it up your ass!
Get out of here!
Go!
Fucking ass out of here before I blow it off!
And so, like, after that, you see that guy Saul sort of, like, walking down the street, and he, like, meets up with Vinny's henchman. You know, Nick Cage has, like, his henchman as to the Joker's Bob from Batman. And Saul's like, shake my hand. And he just, like, murders that guy. To send Nick Cage a message to, like, you know, you don't F with Dutch. Don't mess with me. And then Nick Cage is like, all right, and does, like, a drive-by shooting of the guy. Just, like, totally blows it out of proportion and goes, like, way overkill and, like, lights up an entire street of kids just to kill, like, the one guy.
Including, I don't know if you noticed, but one of those kids who got lit up was Sofia Coppola.
Ooh, Domino. Second Cage Club appearance.
She was out there selling something.
I think they were apples, right? Because he's, like, chewing the apple, waiting for the hit to go down. Because he's not actually in the car. He's just sort of, like, the puppet master of the whole situation.
And so they show her selling an apple to somebody, and then they cut back to Cage, just, like, waiting outside the car. Saul's walking down the street, and in, like, the sloppiest bit of gunplay ever, they must shoot, like, 30 bullets before they come anywhere near hitting Saul.
Yeah, it reeks of amateur hour, right? You know? Like, you see the scene where Saul's, like, precise and direct, and then you see the scene where Vinny is just, like, messy and all over the place.
So when Cage takes out Saul, he sends a message to Dutch, who is essentially the king of New York, at least in terms of the mob scene. Cage becomes public enemy number one, and that's when he holds up in that hotel room.
Did you catch, like, during another quick montage, they had, like, newspapers, like, flying toward the screen?
All those newspapers are amazing, and I'm going to get photos of all of them.
Okay, good.
Because they are all my favorite things.
All right, excellent. I just wanted to be sure. I only want to mention one where they call him Mad Dog Mick.
Yeah.
The most hated man since John Wilkes Booth. Oh my god, I was like, holy crap, like, this is the 20s, but that happened, like, still happened, like, a long time ago in the context of this film.
And obviously killing, you know, a couple kids and a couple other people on the street is awful, but everybody, like, he's just suddenly the most hated man in the world, in a world where crime just runs rampant.
Yeah, I was thinking about that for a minute, too, and I wonder if people were just waiting for the chance to sort of pin it on him, like, they're just waiting for any opportunity to kind of get him out of the game. Because he is very hot-headed, he's very cocky, you know, and he sort of struts around and throws his weight around, even though he's not the one that saved Dutch's life, right? His brother is the reason that he even has, like, this job and stuff. I don't know, I always sort of got a little bit of this in the back of my head, like, any chance they get, they're going to try and take him out, like, if he messes up one time too many.
And so what do they do? Is he... I'm not sure if this actually happened... or if he was just saying it, but did they call in Al Capone to come take him out?
I remember Lucky Luciano showing up later on and then mentioning Al Capone, but is that if that's what happened,
because I don't think Al Capone's in the movie. Lucky Luciano is in the movie.
Who do you think you are, Al Capone? Like,
that might be. Nick Cage thinks he's the Al Capone in New York or whatever, but he's reveling in his most wanted status.
Yeah, and he is off the deep end when he gets the ransom money in the hotel room scene with all the guns. Like, he's in the middle of shaving, so, like, he's got no shirt on, but he's got his suspenders over his shoulders with his pants
on. It's a classic, like, old-timey guy look.
Dude, that is, like, so 20s, right? Like, that's so 20s. Was, like, the epitome of the look. Like, that sequence, I was like, man, Coppola just has the best art department. Great eye for detail. And then he's got, like, the shaving cream on the sides of his face.
Yep.
And it's there the whole scene. It's like he doesn't shave it. He doesn't wipe it off with a towel or anything. He just, like, has it there, I'm assuming, just to, like, kind of show off somehow. Like he just doesn't care.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why it's still there. I don't know. But it's just such a nice little detail, and I love it.
It could just be, like, how casually he takes everything, right? It's like, kidnapping's nothing different than just shaving, you know? It's the same thing, you know? I'm just making the handoff. Let me just shave real quick.
And in that scene, when they're in that hotel room with the shaving cream on, Nicolas Cage and Richard Gere get into a huge, heated argument. It turns out to be, I think, their last interaction, because, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the Cotton Club features Nicolas Cage's first on-screen death in Cage Club. Richard Gere's not happy. Dixie Dwyer's not happy with what's happening to his brother, but he still loves him. And he, in something I don't think I was able to hear on the DVD without subtitles, he hugs him and he gets real close and he just says, "Get out as fast as you can," because he knows what's coming. I'm sure Nicolas Cage knows what's coming too, but Richard Gere wants him to be safe. He wants him to just get out of town and not get killed.
Yeah, it's almost like he's holding on to that delusion that his brother will listen to him or something, you know, that his brother will be like, he knows best. I might as well take his advice for once. But ultimately, I think you're right. They both know that there's Vinny's days are numbered.
And then, like, what does he do immediately following Dixie's bit of advice? He cuts Frenchie's face before letting him go, just because he's like, hey, I'm going to do this, and you're not going to do anything to me because I have the power. It's just like a final act of defiance, and just, like you were saying earlier, it's just amateur hour. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, it's almost adding insult to injury in a weird way. You know, you got your money. You got your 50 grand, all right? And it's 1931, you know, and you've got 50 grand. Like, what are you slicing this guy for? Like, you know they could just come, like, right back, kill you, and get the money. Like, you got to run fast. Like, it was just, again, he's just, like, peacocking.
After Frenchie's let go, there is a really genuinely, like, sweet scene between him and Oni, who's Bob Hoskins. And for the record, Oni is, like, the laziest name in the world for a guy who owns a lot of things.
I thought the same thing, too. When I found out his name and he was the owner of the Cotton Club, I was like, oh my gosh, Oni.
And he even says to Diane Lane, he says to Vera, he's like, I own a lot of things. Like, yeah, your name is Oni. Like, we get it.
I wonder, though, that maybe that was a nickname, you know, and Frenchie was probably a nickname. And, I mean, they were all nicknames, you know, and they were just very uninspired back then.
Well, there is one guy, I'm not sure who he is in the movie, but Alan Garfield plays Abba Dabba Berman.
What? Oh, okay. Maybe one of the dancers?
I don't know. After Frenchie's let go, he goes to Oni, just saying, thanks for getting me out. He's like, hey, can I see your watch? And I think just destroys the watch. And just like, it's sort of, I'm not sure if it's meant for comic effect, but it plays funny and also scary at the same time. He gets really mad because he heard that Oni only offered $500 to get Frenchie out.
Yeah, correct. It comes across like the Joe Pesci scene when he's telling in Goodfellas, you know, the what am I, a clown to you scene? Like, I got a bit of that vibe from this moment, because you're right. It just teeters on the line of, you know, they're doing funny things, but they're being dreadfully serious about it.
Right, and then Oni freaks out. He's like, $500? I gave him $50,000. I would have given him $500,000. And then Frenchie just is so happy to hear that and just pulls out a better, brand-new watch out of his pocket. And Oni's basically just like, oh, man, like, come on.
I know, partners, right? Like, I wondered if they were partners on an even deeper level, and they were trying to hint that, you know, back then that these two guys shared a bed or something. I mean, you know, I don't think it was beyond this film, you know, trying to make all these comments about back in the day to sneak something like that in at the end.
So then in the next scene, it's Cage's death scene.
Yeah.
And he's... Where are they? Are they like in a restaurant or a club?
I think he's in a drugstore. Like, I think he's at like a Woolworths or something, because there's like an old man there, and I saw a lot of like medicine bottles behind the counter, and I think he is like putting his hand in the candy jar.
And so then Nick Cage goes into a phone booth to make a call, and a couple of Dutch's men show up and just gun him down with a Tommy gun. It's a pretty solid death scene.
Yeah, it's Coppola doing what he can do really well when he wants to, like, provide a nice gruesome end to a beloved character. You know, it kind of had like a reminiscent of when Sonny died at the toll booth, you know.
And we get a little bit more just like brutal takeouts a little bit later when Dutch gets what's coming to him. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Or maybe we should, because there's sort of, once Cage dies toward the end of the movie. By this point, Richard Gere has gone to Hollywood. And, like, there's a lot of, like, threads to this that just sort of, like, they tie into the greater narrative, but it also makes me wonder if it could have been done in, like, a different or a better way. He just goes to Hollywood and becomes, like, this huge movie star and stars in a movie called The Mob Boss, which is sort of kind of a screw you to Dutch, that he is now the most famous mob boss, and he comes back to New York. And he's this hero and icon and legend.
Yeah, the movie does another one of its let's have a huge long scene at the Cotton Club where we're just going to end the movie. Like, you know, it's going to take a half hour, but it's going to, like, we'll tie up all the loose ends. And you're right. Like, his success is sort of out of left field in a way. Like, there's one scene where it's pretty funny when producers are watching his screen test and they're like, guy, he's terrible. He can't act. I love him. Bring him out here. And like, Marlene Dietrich, like, comes up to him at one point and is like, you ought to be in pictures or something. And then when he comes back to the Cotton Club, I'm just, like, so confused because, like, first of all, Cage isn't in the rest of the movie, so I'm half checked out. But he's sharing a table with Charlie Chaplin. And, like, James Cagney is there, and I'm just wondering, like, this movie is just sort of, it's, like, overflowing, you know what I'm saying?
It reminds me, like, that the end reminds me sort of Midnight in Paris, but I feel like Midnight in Paris did it for, like, comedic effect, kind of. Like, hey, it's everybody you've ever heard of in this one place. This, it just seems like they're just trying to, like, I don't feel like they're doing it to be funny. They're just trying to show, hey, this is the place to be, and here's everybody you've heard of. And it just sort of seems weird and overstuffed, like you were saying.
Maybe it just is a bit strange to me because, you know, well, I mean, nowadays we see guys like, you know, George Clooney will be at the same fight that Brad Pitt's at, or, you know, maybe they'll be spotted at the same, you know what I mean, like celebrity spotting. So, like, perhaps this is just the 1930s version of celebrity spotting, and it's just jarring because, I don't know, I just never thought of, like, if TMZ was around back then, it would totally have taken off. You know, like, I just didn't expect that scene to exist at the time.
And so the movie pretty much ends, or the last real big scene is that as the movie goes on, Dutch is losing power. He's sort of losing his grasp over his empire. Another group of people come in to move him out and push him out and sort of take over the New York mob scene.
Is this taking place at the same time as Boardwalk Empire takes place? Only ask because Lucky Luciano's on that show as well.
Boardwalk Empire takes place during Prohibition. Wikipedia says during a period of the 1920s and the 1930s. So the Cotton Club takes place, it seems like, pretty much from, like, 28 to, like, 31-ish.
Yeah.
And so it's right in that same sort of sweet spot. It's the same kind of people, the same types of situations, all that sort of same good stuff.
Man, I could have definitely seen Cage on Boardwalk Empire, even at his age today. Like, going back into this era, playing a character, that would have been so great now that I think of it.
Yeah. So Dutch and his whole crew get taken out in a massive sort of shootout. And when I first watched it, it seemed like they were killing a lot of people, but they didn't really kill that many people. They just put a whole lot of bullets into, like, the four they killed.
Yeah, again, like, gangsters weren't very practical killers.
No. You know?
Only Saul. Saul was, like, ahead of his time. But, yeah, the guns they used and the amounts of bullets that they would just waste on one guy, it's almost like in Commando when Schwarzenegger was, like, shooting one guy with 50 rounds. You know, it does seem like a waste, but then again, they probably stole those bullets.
The movie ends with another, I don't know if you felt the same way, but there's like a happy ending at the end where Richard Gere and Diane Lane, she basically says, we can't be together, but keep your eye over your shoulder, maybe we'll meet up again. And he's like, okay. And then, like, they leave, and then all of a sudden they're back together and they ride off into the sunset, and it's a happy ending. As I was watching it, I was thinking it's sort of another misplaced or sort of slightly off happy ending, just like with Racing with the Moon.
Yeah, it almost felt like ending that was, like, tagged on to say goodbye to all the characters in the movie, not necessarily a part of the movie itself, but, like, a sequence so that we could, like, say goodbye to these people, like, as we exit the theater. That's sort of the vibe I got. I didn't really get a sense that the train station took place in reality. I don't know. It felt much more of, like, a blending of reality and dream, because the performance at the club spills over into the train station. Did you pick up on that?
I think so.
The performance at the club, they're, like, dancing on the stage, and they're dressed like they work at the train station, and then they sort of turn the camera around, and there's people walking down the steps of the actual train station, and you'll see a performer from the Cotton Club, like, in the foreground, as if, you know, we just sort of turn the camera around, and they're dancing in the train station with them.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I don't know. I got the sense that was a little more of a surreal moment to tag on the end of the film so that you didn't leave on such a downer.
It does. It just feels weird. It feels a little weird.
It feels very, it feels like that very, like, Hollywood thing to, like, a big Hollywood movie thing of the time. Like, there's just this big, grandiose ending because it's the end and we need to end on a high note.
Although one thing I think I noticed, which makes the end scene worthwhile, I think, and I might be completely wrong about this, but Jennifer Grey walks through the scene next to a casket that's being wheeled, which I can only imagine has Nick Cage's body in it.
Oh, I thought that was Dutch Schultz's casket with his wife next to it, because she's in the movie a lot too, and she's sort of like always left at home while he's out partying with Diane Lane. But that would be even better if that was, I have to rewatch that. If we get like a post-human performance or a post-death performance from the character just wheeled out in a casket, that would be hilarious.
I'm not sure which it actually is. I want to believe that it was Cage.
I'm going to go forward believing it's Cage. I'm not even going to rewatch that moment. I'm just going to say it is.
So now I have a pretty interesting tidbit about this movie. We didn't really talk about Diane Lane that much in this movie, and she's in it all the time. She's in the whole movie.
And she's really, I thought she was good in it. I don't really know her from much, and she is really attractive, and I felt like she had a really good presence in this film for the character she was playing.
What my little tidbit is, and you might, it sounds like you don't agree, she was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Supporting Actress for this movie and for Streets of Fire.
Interesting. I've not seen Streets of Fire. I've heard of that movie. I could imagine someone being nominated from that movie easier than this movie. I'm surprised. I'll tell you this much. I've seen this movie once before, about 10 years ago, and I did not like it. I just didn't like it. I don't know what was up with me back then, but watching it again recently, I did like this movie, and I sort of went along with what it was doing. You know, it's much more of a storybook version of of the mafia and stuff. It's not by any means going by pure, you know, realism here.
So she did not win the Razzie. She lost, quote unquote, lost to Lynn Holly Johnson in some movie that I don't know called Where the Boys Are 84.
Okay. Do not know.
Or Where the Boys Are 84.
The 1984 version of Where the Boys Are.
Okay. Of teen sex comedy film Where the Boys Are. So she didn't win the Razzie. But that's something that I had meant to look up for previous Cage Club movies, if any of them were nominated for some of the bigger awards. The only one that we really missed was Rumblefish was nominated but did not win a Golden Globe for Best Score. But the Cotton Club was nominated for a bunch of awards. We got that Razzie. It was nominated for Best Motion Picture Drama and Best Director at the Golden Globes but did not win. And it was nominated at the Oscars for Best Set Decoration and Best Film Editing, but did not win.
Okay, I told you, Matt, I thought the art direction was great, so I buy the set Oscar nomination there.
There's one other person who I saw in the credits, and I think I saw in the movie, I'm not 100% sure, but so Lawrence Fishburne plays a guy named Bumpy. I believe his name is Bumpy Rhodes. And in the credits, there are several people who are credited only as... There are some people only credited as Bumpy Hood, like, you know, one of Bumpy's hoods or, you know, gang members or whatever. And one of them is Giancarlo Esposito, who played Gus Fring, basically the main bad guy, on Breaking Bad.
Oh, how about that? Awesome.
And so I think I saw him. I'm not 100% sure because in the scene that I saw him in, it's the scene where there's an altercation behind the scenes at the Cotton Club, and they drag that white guy into the bathroom and basically give him a swirly.
Yeah. I think that
one of those guys is Giancarlo Esposito, but like he's sort of like, you know, they're like muscling around and like they don't really have a clear shot of his face, but I think one of them is him.
I also sort of teased a bit of trivia to you earlier today, and it turns out we don't have the same trivia. Now, one of the writers credited to this film was Mario Puzo, as we said way off at the top of the show. Now, Mario Puzo also credited for the story idea and one of the screenwriters for Superman the movie. Nick Gage was supposed to play Superman at one point. So we have another connection there.
We have another Cage connection.
I'm just going to keep looking for the Superman. And Diane Lane and Lawrence Fishburne, of course. We already mentioned them from Rumblefish, you know, more Superman alumni.
I looked up, because when I realized that this was by Francis Ford Coppola, starring basically Diane Lane, I was like, how many times did they work together? And they worked together four movies. They did the two that we've talked about. They were in The Outsiders, which we also talked about. And the movie Jack, I think, with Robin Williams, right, in 1996?
And Bill Cosby.
So, all sorts of greatness in that movie.
That was a tough one, yeah. I don't know what happened.
But yeah, so anything else?
That'll do it for me.
So that was episode 6 of Cage Club. That was The Cotton Club, The Cotton Cage Club.
Nice.
Next up we have Birdie, which again I do not know anything about.
I'm clueless.
Have you seen Birdie?
I have not seen Birdie. I haven't even unsealed the DVD yet.
I don't think I have either. And then I think next week, either early or late in the week next week or early the following week, we have the third and final Coppola Cage connection in Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, Coppola did that one as well. Wow. I didn't know they worked so much together, even though he tried to distance himself from the name. It appears he had no qualms about being directed by his uncle.
I mean, I guess sort of by this point, like, he's really done well. He's demonstrated he's a really good actor in these movies. I mean, why not sort of attach yourself to your uncle, but also to one of the director of some of the best movies that have ever been made, right?
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, well, and I guess we'll see what happens with Peggy Sue Got Married, but next week's Birdie.
So next week you have Birdie, The Boy in Blue, and then Peggy Sue Got Married. So that's three of Cage's first nine movies are with Francis Ford Coppola.
Interesting. Good average.
Good average. That'll just about do it for Cage Club today. We'll see you again next week. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Michael Manzi.